This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight.
And you can see in the main hall the remnants of blood, some bodies, clothes, food, people were eating and fled.
That's VOA regional correspondent Heather Murdoch reporting from Tripoli. Details next also. A United Nations commission warns of a potential crisis in Burundi next year. Nigeria is planning to sign the landmark African Free Trade Agreement during the African Union meeting in Niger this weekend. And police in Kenya are accused of using excessive and unlawful force while in the line of duty. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. The United Nations mission to Libya says at least 44 people were killed and more than 130 wounded in an airstrike on a migrant detention center in the Tajura area near the Libyan capital Tripoli. It's not immediately clear who was responsible for the airstrike. Suspicion has fallen on foreign aircraft allied with General Khalifa Haftar, who is leading an offensive to capture Tripoli from the Government of National Accord. VOA regional correspondent Heather Murdoch is in Tripoli and went to the bombed detention facility in Tajura. She spoke with my colleague Kate Pound-Dawson about what she saw.
Well, the main detention center where people were living was bombed out, as well as a garage. And you can see in the main hall the remnants of blood, some bodies, clothes, food. People were eating and fled. The side halls are mostly burnt out, and there was also clearly victims there. There was about 160 people in the detention center, as far as we know, before the bombing, and there were dozens of people outside. They told us they had been sleeping outside and had not been refreshed with food or water since last night. And police told us dozens of people have also been killed, and as many as 80 are in the hospital right now.
Now, tell us about these detention facilities in general. What are they like? Who is there? Who are these people living in these facilities?
The people living in the facilities are people that were attempting, for the most part, or in the midst of attempting, to try to get to Europe. They come from mostly sub-Saharan Africa, Sudan, Eritrea, Somalia, Nigeria, and other countries. But there's also some Arabs among them and some Bangladeshis. And they're all travelers trying to go to Europe to claim refugee status. Most of them are arrested as they are rescued from the sea. As you know, the boats that refugees take across the Mediterranean Sea into Europe are often deadly and often go down. And so a lot of people have told me that their ship was going down, the Libyan Coast Guard rescued them, and then brought them to this detention center where they cannot leave. These are people fleeing wars and violence, and a lot of them are fleeing extreme poverty, but sometimes that poverty is so dangerous it is just as bad as a war or extreme violence.
Now, what sort of reaction has there been to this attack? Has General Haftar's forces, the Libyan National Army, have they made a statement about this attack? How are people responding in general in Tripoli?
So far, the official response has been muted on both sides, with the Western forces simply saying it happened. We did speak to the commander in charge of the area this morning, and he rather reluctantly said, yes, of course, it must be Haftar's forces that did it. Haftar himself and the Libyan National Army has not released a statement officially claiming responsibility for this, but it is expected this is a part of the ongoing war. This area has been targeted before, and while I'm not sure, people say it's not a military base. It is inside a compound that says Ministry of the Interior on it, and it has been targeted prior.
Now, I understand that there are some militias or other forces allied with the Government of National Accord in that area. Is that correct? Do you know if that's correct?
It's not something I can confirm because it's something that the people who are detained themselves, who are now standing outside the bombed-out detention center looking, wondering where they're going to go, they said that they never saw any militias or a police or soldiers associated with the government of National Accord, aside from ordinary security guards. And the government of National Accord itself denies this being a legitimate military target. So I can't confirm that, but past history of the place suggests that it might be a military target.
That was VOA correspondent Heather Murdoch in Tripoli. She spoke with Kate Pound-Dawson. Haftar's Libyan National Army, which backs the government in eastern Libya, has seen its advance on Tripoli stalled on the city's edge. Commanders this week threatened airstrikes after traditional means of war had been exhausted. Haftar says his goal is to create a unified government to bring stability to Libya, but his attempt to capture Tripoli has derailed UN attempts to broker an end to the chaos that has prevailed since the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. A UN commission on Burundi says the country is poised for another political crisis when it holds elections next year. The three-member commission of inquiry says the ruling party is trying to harass and intimidate opponents and creating the conditions for unfair elections. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
The chair of the Commission of Inquiry on Burundi warns the democratic space in the country is rapidly shrinking. Senegalese lawyer Dudu Dien says the government's efforts to convince observers the situation has returned to normal since the 2015 political crisis ring hollow. President Pierre Nkurunziza's decision to run for a controversial third term in 2015 provoked deadly clashes, prompting hundreds of thousands of people to flee the country to escape threats and violence. Dien, who presented the Commission's report to the UN Human Rights Council on Tuesday, says serious human rights abuses have continued. He says the abuses have a political dimension as they occurred following the May 2018 referendum, which amended the Constitution, allowing Nkurunziza to run for at least two more terms. Speaking through an interpreter, Dien says most of the victims are opponents and members of a new party aimed at defeating the ruling party.
Members of this party are regularly subject to threats, arbitrary arrests and detentions, beatings, even torture. The party itself faces several challenges in conducting basic activities, such as organizing meetings or opening offices.
Dien says the commission has well-founded fears about the fairness of the 2020 elections. He says free and credible elections cannot occur when only the ruling party is able to operate and when independences are stifled. Again, through an interpreter.
The history of elections in Burundi, including last year's constitutional referendum, has always been marred by violence and serious human rights violations. Some worrying signs can already be seen in the current pre-electoral background.
The commission is urging Burundi's government to take strong measures to renew the vitality of the democratic space, which is necessary for holding credible elections. Burundi's ambassador to the UN in Geneva, Renovat Tabu, has rejected the report, which he says offers an apocalyptic picture of a plan of destabilization on the eve of the election. The ambassador says the commission has presented no proof that the election could become the scene of a serious deterioration of human rights. He says it is easy to lie when claims cannot be verified and calls the commission report an act of sabotage. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari will sign the landmark African trade agreement during the African Union meeting in Niger this weekend. His office tweeted the news late yesterday. Nigeria, Africa's most populous nation, had backed the plan to reduce trade barriers on the continent since negotiations began in 2002. But under pressure from unions and businesses that feared they would not be able to compete under the deal, Nigeria declined to sign it last year when other AU members did. Last week, a government panel studying the potential impact of joining the deal, known as AFTA, endorsed signing on. AFTA came into force at the end of May after 22 countries ratified it. Proponents say the agreement could increase regional trade by 60%. Currently, only about 16% of trade by African nations is with other African states because of high tariffs. Fifteen past the hour, you are listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Zimbabwe's health workers, who have cut back to working just twice a week because of the erosion of their salaries, were expecting a new payment schedule from government this week. It hasn't arrived. And as reporter Kudzadze Nawashi tells us, many Zimbabweans also had expected a nationwide labor action this week to register public unhappiness with the poor state of the economy.
Health workers in Zimbabwe had been promised new payment schedules by Monday. It hasn't arrived. Panganai Chivese is the team leader of the Health Workers Apex Council, which has been in talks with the government.
I haven't had any new development yet, only that people are anticipating that something is going to happen in terms of the promise, the 1 July. So we are still waiting for that feedback.
As health workers wait, the Minister of Finance, Mthuli Ncube, told Parliament Monday that the government will soon review civil servants' incomes. With inflation now at 100%, Zimbabweans in all employment sectors struggle to support their families. The Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions has threatened mass action to pressure government to act on this crisis. Tinei Munetsi is the coordinator at Tajamuka, a pressure group that had called for a stay-away labor action.
Yes, Tajamuka, we forwarded our petition to the head of state, President Mnangagwa. We also petitioned the parliament in respect with our constitution. We had given them 7 days to respond to some of the demands.
Mass actions are not new to Zimbabwe. During the last days of Zimbabwe's long-time ruler, Robert Mugabe, nationwide protests and stayaways became regular events. Tajamuka, which organized several such protests during Mugabe's era, called for a business shutdown to start on Monday. But that call received a lukewarm reception. Munetsi explains why.
I would say the turnout was not that as what we were expecting as a pressure group. We had consulted the citizens, and the citizens were saying they are ready to be part of the payaway. People are still scared in the country because of the last victimization which was done by the state.
Munetsi is referring to the police crackdown on protests over rising fuel costs in January. More than 600 people were arrested and scores were injured as police shut down demonstrations. Medical workers said at least 60 people suffered gunshot wounds. He says the labor movement's efforts are not over, but going forward, they will be consulting citizens on what action to take. He doesn't rule out the possibility of other shutdowns and other forms of peaceful protest. Munetsi says it will take all progressive Zimbabweans and a variety of stakeholders to pull together toward one common goal. He suggests holding an inclusive dialogue aimed at finding solutions to Zimbabwe's many challenges. For VOA, this is Kudzadze Nawashe from Harare.
Police in Kenya have often been accused of using excessive and unlawful force while in the line of duty. A new report published today by Human Rights Watch finds that police were involved in the killings of at least 21 people since August 2018 in just two of Kenya's informal settlements. Rael Ambor reports from Nairobi.
On the evening of April 28, 2017, Isaac Kamau Mwangi left his mother's house in Nairobi's Kayole estate to pick up his car at a car wash. His sister Ruth Mumbi says those were his final hours. A motorcycle driver told the family what happened to him.
He was on his knees pleading with people who wanted to kill him. And the only thing that the boda-boda driver had was the shot and my brother screaming loud, calling out my name. I came to know the following day that he was killed by officers.
Colleagues remembered Kamau as a devoted taxi driver, his family as a loving father of two. To police, however, he was a wanted highway robber. Kamau's death is one of hundreds of cases of extrajudicial police killings documented by rights groups in Kenya. In its new report, Human Rights Watch accuses police of killing at least 21 suspects since August 2018 in Dandora and Mathare, two of Nairobi's slums. Human Rights Watch researcher Otieno Namwaya says the killings bore similarities.
The common trend was that either the police brand somebody a thief and then either warn the person or put their name on social media. And then a week or two later, the person is found dead or they ambush the person somewhere, either in the house or in the street, arrest the person or ask the person to kneel down and then shoot the person in broad daylight, sometimes in the full glare of the public.
The report says the Independent Policing Oversight Authority, IPOA, Kenya's police accountability institution, has not done enough to stop police from killing people. Since inception of the oversight body in 2011, there have only been 6 convictions of police officers accused of extrajudicial killings. Anne Makori, the IPOA chairperson, says the organization has investigated more than 5,500 cases and sent more than 1,900 others to the Public Prosecutor's Office, the ODPP.
Because we have investigative powers, where we find the officer is culpable, we forward that file to ODPP with a recommendation for prosecution because we don't have prosecutorial powers. As we speak, we have 164 files within ODPP and we have 49 files within the court system.
Mumbi says that in most cases, families like hers never find justice as witnesses are usually afraid to come forward.
For this case, the person who came to report to us, who saw what Kamau had gone through, was also afraid. In fact, he even changed his number and he doesn't even live in Nairobi.
In the Human Rights Watch report, Kenya's police spokesman is quoted as saying, any officer who breaches the law must face the consequences as an individual. He said the Independent Policing Oversight Authority ought to investigate the killings in Dandora and Mathare and ensure the culprits are prosecuted. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
In Sudan, opposition activists are planning for major no protests against the military government in the coming days. And around the world, Sudanese expatriates have held demonstrations in solidarity with protesters in their home country, demanding the country's military junta hand power to a civilian government. For VOA, Jason Patinkin talked to protesters in the U.S. city of Chicago.
Wearing blue headscarves and draped in Sudanese flags, nearly 100 people gathered in the U.S. city Chicago, chanting revolutionary slogans to call for civilian rule in their home country of Sudan. The protest in Chicago was part of a series of rallies taking place around the world in solidarity with Sudan's revolution, which started in December and has demanded that a military government hand power to civilians. On Sunday, Sudanese protesters turned out across the African nation in what opposition leaders are calling a Millions March, one of the largest marches in the country since the revolution began over 6 months ago. Amin El Said, a Sudanese-American student, helped organize the Chicago protest.
We're standing with our brothers and sisters in Sudan right now who are gathering for a Million Man March. to once again stand up against an oppressive and brutal military regime that's been in power for over 30 years. We want the world to know that what's happening in Sudan cannot go unnoticed. People are dying. People are giving up their lives for basic human rights and basic freedoms.
Sunday marks the 30-year anniversary of a military coup in Sudan that ended democratic rule and brought dictator Omar al-Bashir to power. Bashir's regime was accused of corruption and human rights abuses, including an alleged genocide in the country's Darfur region. Bashir's military ousted him in April after mass protests, but the generals refused to hand over power to a civilian government. In June, regime soldiers killed over 100 peaceful protesters calling for civilian rule, according to Sudanese doctors. In Chicago, Sudanese-American citizen Saleh Magoub said she hopes international rallies will push the global community to help Sudan's protesters achieve their demands.
We're seeing exactly what happened in Darfur is happening now in Khartoum and for the entire country, where people are getting murdered, raped, and there's no justice. So all we're trying to do is bring attention to that, and we're hoping that we'll have more people supporting us. The international community, whether it's the UN, the US, the EU, really any attention that we can get so we can help the people of Sudan is what we're looking for.
International support for the revolution has been organized online with the hashtag #BlueForSudan. And in Chicago, people wore blue to show solidarity with Sudan's protesters. Some non-Sudanese people joined the Chicago rally, holding signs, chanting, and signing a large poster to show their support for the revolution. Sarah Boyer, a teacher, urged Americans to pressure their government to act.
People are being shot down, and it's horrible. And you, one person, one email, one phone call can do anything. Call your senators, email your senators, follow the hashtags on all of social media, anything blue for Sudan.
Nagla Al-Hassan, a doctor from Khartoum who has lived in the U.S. the last 18 years, said she wants protesters in Sudan to know that the diaspora supports them.
I want just to send a message to people in Sudan. Keep the faith, keep the strength. We are there. We are fighting for you. Even we know that you are inside. Your demands is very tough, and it's very hard for you to demand for anything. But we are outside to fight for you.
With support growing around the world, Sudan's revolution is far from over. Jason Patinkin for VOA News, Chicago.
And in a brief sports update, the final 16 teams in the Africa Cup of Nations has been set, with Morocco taking on Benin Friday in Cairo and Uganda challenging Senegal. The other teams in the round are Algeria, Cameroon, Democratic Republic of Congo, Egypt, Ghana, Guinea, Ivory Coast, Madagascar, Mali, Nigeria, South Africa, Tunisia, and Uganda. The round of 16 goes through Monday, and semi-final matches begin a week from today. To stay updated on the latest in the Africa Cup of Nations, be sure to tune in to the Sunny Side of Sports. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Patrick Dea, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, the newly elected Nigerian United Nations General Assembly President pledges to focus on peace and prosperity for the most vulnerable. Nigeria at the helm of the UNGA on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
Join your host, Larry London, for Border Crossings, VOA's Worldwide Music Request Hour, every weekday at 1500 Universal. Tune in to hear your favorite songs and artists, win prizes and giveaways, and get the latest scoop from exclusive celebrity interviews. Send in requests to our Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, or call 202-618-2077 to have your favorite music played for the entire world. Don't miss Border Crossings every weekday at 1500 Universal.